In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Far, far too much of leftist ideology is a rejection of reality. We certainly see that right now in the halls of government as Democrats bravely try to stand in the way of democracy. People voted for Trump because they wanted change. People voted for Trump because they wanted government efficiency. People voted for Trump because it was obvious to the people that we cannot keep going down the road that we have been going, ignoring all the danger signs of reality, and pretend that things are okay. And yet there the Democrats are, standing outside of buildings, shrieking and demanding that all of the spending, the endless spending, keeps on going and going. But even some Republicans are now meeting behind closed doors with Susie Wiles, Trump's chief of staff, to complain about some of those cuts that are happening. It's because both parties are in on it. In my opinion, every single government meeting needs to start with the question, what part of $36 trillion in debt do you not understand? We've already uncovered hundreds of billions of dollars of fraud and waste and abuse, and gosh, just like what we've been saying for going on 15 years now, a lot of those taxpayer dollars are cycling back into Democrat pockets. And that's an investigation currently underway by the DOGE team. One of the lead investigators is now using artificial intelligence to go through millions of financial records to track money, public money, that goes to bureaucrats, administrators, and members of Congress, and/or their family members, who, for example, sit on the boards of some of these NGOs or nonprofits, or just happen to own a business that contracts with the government. The goal is to expose who in government is personally benefiting from government spending. I think we're about to find out exactly why so many congresspeople enter Congress poor but leave Congress fabulously wealthy. It's no wonder they're howling. In the first half of this week's show, we're going to continue our look at these activist judges and do that with a practicing attorney. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to look at a conspiracy theory that people have been urging us to look at for more than 15 years. And while I'm still not quite ready to believe it, there is another angle to it that I certainly do believe. I'd like to welcome Kimberly Herman back to the show. She is the Executive Director for Southeastern Legal Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending liberty, and will sue government overreach whenever the government decides to violate your constitutional rights, which is something that happened far too often during the Biden years. Kimberly, it is great to talk to you today.
It's great to be back with you.
So we wanted to have you on to talk about an exciting moment for you and Southeastern Legal Foundation, and then the flu and a whole bunch of other complications popped up to prevent us from that. But so this is, we're talking about an event that's happened a couple of weeks back. But before we get to that moment, Southeastern Legal sues government overreach when it violates constitutional rights. Now, I know there's an awful lot of damage out there yet to repair. But what's your assessment of the Trump administration these last 5 weeks? Do you get the sense he is pulling back on the reins of government? And perhaps, just perhaps, we'll see less new government overreach in the next 4 years.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen executive order after executive order. And but what these executive orders are doing is exactly that. It's reining back the power. It's kind of crazy. And I know we're going to get into it a little bit more about some of these opinions and these lawsuits challenging these executive orders. But what these lawsuits are trying to do is actually keep the bureaucrats in office, right? What President Trump is trying to do is reduce the power that these unelected bureaucrats have over our lives. And I've been very pleased at what I've seen come out of the White House so far.
Well, I thought you might be, and we'll come back around to that in a moment or two. But back to that exciting moment. You got a special invite to attend a signing ceremony for something that you and Southeastern Legal Foundation have been fighting for, defending women's and girls' rights. And it was so exciting for us to see you at that signing ceremony, knowing how hard you had personally been in that fight. So tell our audience what that ceremony was for, what it was like to get that invite, and what it was like to be there in that room.
Oh my gosh, it was such a special day. So we got to go up to the White House for the signing of President Trump's executive order ensuring that women's sports are for women only, right? And so this is something that we've been fighting for. We've been fighting to save Title IX. We brought a lawsuit on behalf of Moms for Liberty and Young America's Foundation, and we obtained the country's broadest injunction at the time, stopping the Biden administration from changing the definition of sex to mean gender identity, which would allow anyone, any man, any boy who believed or thought or said that they were a girl to play in girls' sports. We were able to stop that. And President Trump kept one of his biggest campaign promises, which was to keep men and boys out of women and girls' sports by signing this executive order. And we got to be there with our clients, with our clients' daughters, and I got to take my 7-year-old softball-loving daughter to the White House to witness the signing of this executive order. It was such a special moment.
Well, it looks so special. We got to see you on a couple of different clips. We got to see her rushing forward there and being part of that, and right up there near the desk when he's doing the signing. So that just looks so cool. You know, it was about a year ago when I had talked with your friend Sarah Parshall Perry, a senior legal fellow over the Heritage Foundation, who I thought did a great job of summing up the attack on Title IX that Biden was doing. And she said under the original Title IX, whatever rights boys and men had in education and sports, girls and women did too. And then effectively what Biden did was throw all of that out and say whatever rights girls and women used to have, boys and men who think they are girls and women now have. And so girls and women effectively had no rights. How on earth did anyone ever, especially, you know, the so-called party of women and for women's rights, the Democrats, why on earth would anyone ever have thought that was a good idea?
Your guess is as good as mine, right? And we still see this today. I mean, I go even just open up my personal social media and see people that are furious about this executive order, which baffles me because, you know, we're putting our girls at physical danger by allowing boys to play in sports with them, right? There are physiological differences. They are much stronger. And we're also putting them at, you know, personal privacy danger. No girl should ever have to change in a locker room or go to a bathroom with a biological boy there. And the fact that we even have to say biological boy instead of just boy is insane to begin with. But this is more of that effort that we've talked about to really pull kids away from their families and to destroy the nuclear family. That's at the end of the day, call me a conspiracy theorist, but that's what this is all about.
Well, I seem to recall that shortly before Biden left office, didn't they rescind that rewrite of Title IX? And it also seems like it was looking doomed within the judiciary that a judge had placed a stay on that rewrite, or at least part of it. So had it worked its way through the courts, is this one of those that never stood a ghost of a chance, or could it have stood up?
So it did. There were actually eight federal lawsuits filed challenging the changes, and the Biden administration really dug in strong. The problem for them was that in every single court case, when it would reach the highest level in that circuit, the courts sided with all of us who believe in reality and biological reality, and said that these changes violated First Amendment rights. They violated personal privacy. They violated the state's ability to protect, you know, students and parents and teachers in their state, you know, borders. And so they just lost time and time again. And then finally a court in Kentucky said that's enough. And they basically said this rule can never go into effect in this country. And so we got a great result out of the case. And then Trump came in and he said never again.
Good.
With this executive order.
That's awesome. Okay, it is time for a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some executive orders and start digging into those activist judges out there. We'll do that with Kimberly Herman, the executive director for Southeastern Legal Foundation. Find out about the great work they do at slfliberty.org. And welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show. We're talking today to Kimberly Herman. She is executive director for Southeastern Legal Foundation, which fights to defend your constitutional rights when government decides to run right over them. Their website, again, is slfliberty.com. That's slfliberty.com. I'm sorry, .org, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com, and that's show 15-09. And so you mentioned in that previous segment there that Trump has been signing kind of a blizzard of executive orders. Are there any executive orders that he signed so far that really impact the work that you guys do?
There's a number of them, right? And ones I think to point out for everyone are the ones that he's done with respect to DEI and specifically DEI in education, right? And so President Trump has come out and said that federal funds will no longer be spent on critical race theory and DEI in our public schools. And, you know, there's been some pushback on this, and we've seen some lawsuits filed and stuff. But at the end of the day, what this executive order does is it says the government cannot discriminate against people based on race, based on the color of their skin, and that it's going to be the policy of his administration to follow the law. There's nothing really novel about this executive order, except for the fact that for the last 4 years, our federal government has been doing the complete opposite. And so he is making it known with this that no longer will there be racial discrimination in this country, that we have a colorblind constitution, and that's what he intends to follow. And so I think that that is a huge one that's going to impact a lot of work that we do here at Southeastern Legal Foundation.
It really seems to be a mental block for so many people on the left that when you discriminate against a race, you know, that's not okay. But when you discriminate in favor of a race, somehow that becomes okay. I've never quite understood that mental block that they can't see past that when you discriminate in favor of either a race of people or genders and whatnot, that is itself a form of discrimination. Why don't they get that?
I don't know, but you know what ends up happening is blatant discrimination.
Absolutely.
Right? A great example is what happened up in Evanston, Illinois, in a case that we filed a federal lawsuit on and that we have an OCR complaint in front of the Department of Education today. It's been going on since 2019, and it is sitting at the U.S. Department of Education today, ready for them to actually take action on, but where there was segregation happening in this school. And when I say that, people go, really? Like, really segregation today in 2025? But yes, teachers walk into a training, white teachers are sent to one room, non-white teachers to another room.
Wow.
They didn't do it in just one training. They did it time and time again, and with the kids.
Wow.
That should shock everyone's conscience. And President Trump and his Department of Education and his Department of Justice is going to stop that from happening going forward.
Well, when you've got that blatant level of segregation where they're clearly, you know, putting the different races into different rooms, didn't Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, didn't that effectively wipe that all out? So I'm surprised this is still going on.
I mean, go back to Brown versus Board of Education, right? Correct. This is clearly unconstitutional. It is illegal. It is immoral. And under Trump 45, the Department of Education in that particular case agreed with us and agreed with our client. And they issued a formal letter of finding saying, "You school district, you cannot do that, right? It is illegal. You have to stop." But 2 days into the Biden administration, they withdrew that letter of finding. And I think the words used were, it was put on ice. And so now we've actually been asking this administration to take action on that and to reinstate that finding. And, you know, our client has been so brave. She's had protests against her. She has had violence in the classroom against her. And she still stands strong because she believes in the Constitution. And we know that President Trump does, too. And so we're hopeful that we'll get reinstatement of that very soon.
Well, I certainly look forward to getting back to a colorblind constitution. I think that would be awesome. But we really wanted to have you on to talk about some of these activist judges who are trying to thwart democracy. And I'd like to just kind of review something that we talked about last week with James Hurson. And it was something that Stephen Miller, the White House spokesman, said. You know, he was talking to the media who are all in a tizzy about DOGE and Trump slashing budgets and personnel, only to have these activist judges throw themselves in the way of the train. And just to summarize that, he said Article 2 has a clause known as the vesting clause, and it says the executive power shall be vested in a president, singular. The whole will of democracy of all of America is imbued into the elected president. The threat to democracy, the existential threat to democracy, is the unelected bureaucracy of lifetime tenured civil servants who believe they answer to no one. And what President Trump is doing, he's now removing federal bureaucrats who are defying democracy by failing to implement his lawful orders, which is the whole will of the American people. And I think that really sums all of that up in a nice, neat nutshell. What are your thoughts on that?
I think when Stephen Miller spoke at that press conference, he did an amazing job for starters. But I agree with it, right? It is crazy to think that we have our president of the United States who has his cabinet and who oversees all of these federal agencies. And we have judges saying that he cannot direct the policy of those agencies. It would be like telling a CEO that he does not have the authority to direct to direct his company and to determine the future and, you know, what products his company is going to have, what services they're going to offer. It is no different here. It is not like he is telling Congress what to do or telling the courts what to do, right? That's where separation of powers comes into play. What is being forgotten here is that these federal agencies are part of the executive branch. And they fall under the president's power. And he is not trying to overreach here like we saw with Biden and Obama. He is actually trying to rein in the power of these federal agencies and say, you guys are doing way too much. You've taken way too much power. We're going to give it back to the people.
Well, in terms of you mentioned that about it would be like telling the CEO he doesn't have the power to make staffing changes and the rest. But I think one of the most absurd orders was when they were telling the secretary, the duly appointed and confirmed secretary of the Treasury himself couldn't look at these records. I mean, that is absurd. Yeah. Is this something that higher courts would think is okay and allow that to go forward?
I mean, it shouldn't, right? As it eventually reaches the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't think that it will. But again, you know, we have these judges, and I'm not going to characterize them, but we have these judges issuing orders that make absolutely no sense when you look at our constitutional structure of this country. And, you know, as they work their way up to the Supreme Court, like we saw yesterday, right? We saw the Supreme Court say, you know, that the administration did not have to give out this obscene amount of money in U.S. aid.
Right, the foreign aid.
And I think we're going to see more of that. And what's even crazier here to me is that we have lawsuits against these executive orders.
Yeah.
Right. Executive orders set the policy of an administration. Normally, you don't start suing until you get regulations and actual final agency action. The fact that these lawsuits are moving forward in the first place when there's no actual injury here, that's a whole entire another problem with these opinions that are coming
out. Yeah, in
fact,
I'd like to follow up with that on you in the next segment here. We are up against a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Kimberly Herman, the Executive Director of Southeastern Legal. Stay with us. We're talking today with Kimberly Herman. She's the Executive Director for Southeastern Legal Foundation. Their website is slfliberty.org. That's slfliberty.org. And you can find that link on ispyradio.com. To this week's show is 15-09. And Kimberly, during the break there, we were talking about some of the nonsense here that these judges are doing. And that, in fact, you said in the last break too, is that normally you do not sue over executive orders. Do judges have the authority to stop these executive orders or not? I mean, otherwise, it just sounds like, and in fact, this was something we covered last week as well, is if we have these unelected judges that can just overrule anything the executive branch does, what's the point of elections?
Yeah, I mean, normally in order to bring a federal lawsuit, you have to have somebody that has an injury and you have to have what's called a case in controversy, which sounds very legal, but it's basically saying somebody has been injured by what you're challenging. And so, you know, when President Biden took office, we didn't like his executive orders. We disagreed with the policy in them, but they were directing the federal agencies to then go take action, to make rules, to issue guidance, to enforce, start investigations, whatever it may be. And then we sued on those rules and regulations that came out. And so, you know, the race to the courthouse here has been a very obvious political ploy to try to freeze up this administration. Trump 47 is a very well-organized administration. They have come in with a plan and an agenda and campaign promises that they're going to keep. And the left is obviously going to do anything to slow them down. But we all know President Trump. And I don't think he wants to be slowed down. They're going to play by the rules, but they're going to get done what they need to get done.
Well, that brings up another question there. What happens if he were to defy these orders?
So, I mean, if you defy, if anyone, right, president or not, if you defy a temporary restraining order, a preliminary injunction, you're going to be brought back into the courtroom and the judge is not going to be happy. So it's not something that I expect them to do. Of course, I'm not there. But, you know, these are very, very smart legal minds. We've got Pam Bondi running our Department of Justice, which all Americans should be very happy about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so they're going to run this DOJ with order. They're going to run it fairly. You know, we've seen Harmeet Dhillon testifying yesterday, who's going to be running the Civil Rights Office, if she's confirmed, which I think she will be, you know, saying this is not a weapon. Right. We are going to follow the law and put rule of law back into our country. And so I don't think that we're going to see them defying this. We're going to see them fighting it because they're on the right side of the law here.
Yeah, I would certainly think so. You mentioned Pam Bondi. She's the head of the DOJ, which is part of the executive branch. What power does she have, if any, over these judges?
The judges, like you said, they are an independent judiciary. Right. We have three branches of government for a reason. And we want them to be independent judges. We might not like what they're doing. We might not like their opinions. We might have thoughts about how to characterize it. But that is also why we have the appellate courts, and that's why we have the Supreme Court. It takes time to work their way through, but clearly these cases are going to get the attention of the Supreme Court very, very quickly. And so I think we'll see a lot of these on expedited review work their way up there.
Well, I would certainly think so, but this notion that you can just sue the executive branch continuously, whether these are executive orders or rules or agency moves or anything else, I mean, it's really starting to make you wonder. I mean, again, it gets back to these are unelected judges, and yet they're stopping the will of democracy, which is what the Democrats said that they were fighting for, was democracy and this threat to democracy. But it has, I've seen a lot of discussion online in articles and whatnot that maybe it's time that we rethink these judges and these lower courts. And Article 3, Section 1 says this: the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both of the Supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior. So what does that phrase good behavior mean? Has that ever been truly defined, and do we need to redefine it?
I mean, there have been, and I'm not an expert on impeachment of judges, but there have been judges that have been impeached. But, you know, I don't know if this is that situation, right? There's going to be opinions that we disagree with. There's going to be legal analysis that we disagree with. You know, that in and of itself is not going to be cause for removal by the bench. Now, some of the comments that are being made in conjunction with these opinions could be suspect and they could be evaluated, right? But just as a constitutional lawyer, I think the better course of action is to work these cases through the courts and get them up to the U.S. Supreme Court as quickly as possible. Because again, when the law is on your side, you don't need to be attacking your opponent like that. And the opponent here might be a judge, right? That's for them to decide. But the law is on their side. Let the Constitution stand for what it is.
Well, as far as Constitution there and this notion of good behavior, it seems like an irony or catch-22 situation, because wouldn't it be up to the courts to decide, like, for example, if Congress wanted to come in and effectively define what exactly good behavior is, wouldn't it then be up to the courts to decide if Congress's redefinition of good behavior is constitutional?
Potentially, if somebody challenged it in the court of law, right? But, I mean, at the end of the day, impeachment hearings go, you know, before Congress. They are big deals. And, you know, there's just some things that I think we need to be careful with, right? And it does come down to rule of law. And I think that, you know, I don't think that this Trump administration is going to go to that point with respect to all of these, because then it would undermine the good opinions that they eventually get, right? And when the Constitution does win the day, it could only undermine that. And so It's a lot of talk out there by pundits, and it's a lot of great discussion. But at the end of the day, again, Constitution is what it is, and it's on our side here.
Well, it just seems ironic that with all of the effort that Trump is putting into reining in government, we've got judges now trying to keep it going and keep expanding it, and all of the mess that big government is. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Kim Herman, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Since our earliest days here on iSpy Radio, we were approached by a lot of people asking us to look into chemtrails. But those who did not have a good answer to my question to them. But if they are out there spraying chemicals in the air, doesn't that mean that who's ever doing it would be doing it to themselves too? And that usually resulted in a long silence followed by dubious and flimsy explanations. What exactly was being sprayed was also, excuse the pun, up in the air. No one quite knew. We said we'd look into it if someone could get a reliable, trustworthy source, and usually what was sent to us was just a link to some guy on the internet making claims with a lot of speculation, but no real reliable evidence. But we're convinced that something was happening. In the years since, we still occasionally get asked about it, but now finally some credible sources are coming forward, including, interestingly enough, NOAA itself and NASA, but even they don't seem to know what is or isn't happening, or even what may or may not be being sprayed into the atmosphere. To try to sort things out and to take a few hesitant steps down this rabbit trail, I'd like to welcome Chuck Weiss back to the show. Chuck is the perfect person to answer this. He's a scientist, meteorologist, global warming debunker, and a pilot. Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Mark.
Yeah, so we want to talk to you about this article on Just the News. We'll put it up on today's show page 1509 on iSpyRadio.com. And it's kind of curious and a little confusing and needs a better editor, quite frankly. It's about a little-known war over climate technology in which billions are apparently being invested not only in things like cloud seeding but also more controversial practices such as geoengineering techniques like solar radiation management and stratospheric aerosol injection. Each of those are designed to reduce global temperatures by reflecting a portion of the sun's energy back into space. And that part is nothing new. They've been talking about maybe doing that, and even Bill Gates, I think, is involved in that. But now it's looking like that may start happening. But I'd like to start, though, with kind of getting some definitions here, because there's four main areas here, I think, to sort through. There's cloud seeding, which does, in fact, have a real history. There's contrails versus chemtrails. And then there's also geoengineering. So let's start with cloud seeding. This does, in fact, have some legitimacy. There are some studies that show that seeding it with things like silver iodide does have an effect up to 5 to 10% in areas that are looking for more rain and more snow. They're currently using it in places like Utah and Wyoming. So what can you tell us about cloud seeding?
Well, cloud seeding, Mark, has a very long history, as you pointed out. NOAA and the American Meteorological Society in the early days had looked into a number of possibilities as to what the legitimacy of this might be and how it might be able to be used mainly to combat drought situations. It wasn't, and in its inception, it had nothing to do with climate change. It was, is there any way we could seed clouds to end droughts that had occurred periodically in the climate records? And so we know what the physics of cloud seeding involves. We know how droplets are turned into ice crystals and then fall in the form of precipitation, either rain or snow. We know all about how that works. And the idea behind cloud seeding was to take, as you point out, silver iodide and put it into clouds, hoping to form some ice crystals, which would initiate a precipitation process. But what they found out in doing all these experiments that were done several decades ago is that it had very, very limited success. In fact, for the most part, you can just chalk it up to being a complete failure, because what scientists that did these experiments discovered was that you had to have a very special condition to get any effect out of it at all, which was basically a weather system which was isolated. You had a cloud deck with cold air in the cloud that was causing supercooled water to form in the cloud. And the silver iodide was simply a catalyst which allowed the ice crystals to form in that situation and cause some very light amounts of precipitation. Outside of that specialized condition, an isolated cloud with cold air in it, not really connected to any synoptic scale or large-scale weather systems, you could get a very, very minor amount of precipitation out of it. But if you put it into regular clouds, that which is 99% of what's going on around the Earth at any particular time, and a lot of the clouds in the tropics don't even have ice crystals in them because it's so warm down there, you get coalescence of water to be able to form precipitation in the tropics. So that process kind of excludes using silver iodide for it, for anything. And then if you try to put it in mid-latitude weather systems, it has no measurable effect at all. The other things simply dwarf the effect of adding some silver iodide to it. So a lot of us who looked at this at the very beginning thought it's going to be a complete waste of time to do this. It won't have any effect that will really alleviate a true drought. Nature is the only thing that can do that, and that hasn't changed since then. So any attempts to seed clouds today are not going to have an effect to produce any measurable effect to end droughts or increase precipitation whatsoever. We just don't have the statistics available to show that. And like I said, the success in implementing it was extremely limited. Only very special cases could you get any effect from it at all.
Yeah.
So it's a failure, and it's not going to work. It's not going to. So you try to apply this to weather climate modification. It's just laughable. You're not going to get any effect by doing this at all.
Well, and then the second broad category is contrails versus chemtrails. And contrails are what, you know, come out of jets and stuff as they take off. A lot of people see those patterns, and maybe you could talk about that, because it does look like, you know, somebody's going back and forth. But as I understand it, it's a plane taking off, and then a few minutes later, another plane takes off, and but the wind has now shifted that original contrail and does that repeatedly. So so that's the pattern that people are seeing. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, the jet contrail thing is nothing new, and the claims that they're spraying things out of commercial aircraft is complete nonsense. I flew jetliners for the major carriers for a good number of years, and believe me, if there was anything being loaded on those airplanes that was for the purpose of doing that and any attempt to hide it from us, they couldn't. We'd know all about it. It has to be included in a weight and balance manifest. So you couldn't sneak it onto any commercial airplane, and the company would probably object to it. Any company would object to the government wanting to use its equipment for that purpose just because of potential liability, even if they believed in it. So it's not going on with commercial aircraft. Is it going on with government aircraft? I don't know the answer to that because I'm not privy to get any information from the government. The only thing that I can say about it is that the contrails, I don't know what the objective of doing it would be. It's not to form ice crystals or anything like that. Maybe to form clouds or something to block sunlight. I think that was some of the idea behind these people that are claiming they can get, that they can get some success from it. But I don't know that it would work for anything. I mean, I think these people that do these things, a lot of the people that come up with these ideas, in my opinion, are incompetent. They're not competent to look at what they're really faced with in the way of a major challenge to accomplish anything in regards to changing the Earth's climate.
Right.
And so proceeding with anything like this, it's just going to be complete foolishness and nonsense. The crisscross patterns that people see say is proof they're spraying. That is not true. That's not proof of anything because the air traffic system is congested all the time with airplanes at different altitudes. And oftentimes airplanes are only separated by 1,000 feet. And anytime these jets are flying in areas where there's high relative humidity and cold temperatures, they're going to throw contrails.
Right. We are up against the clock here. Coming back, we're going to be talking about geoengineering, which is something that cloud seeding has morphed into. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're digging into chemtrails today because there's another element of that that I think has far, far more validity, and that is geoengineering. We're talking with Chuck Weiss. He's a meteorologist, trained scientist, global warming debunker, and also a former pilot, and so he knows quite a bit about this. And Chuck, I mentioned going out of that last segment that cloud seeding kind of morphed into geoengineering, and there was, I believe it was Truman and then Eisenhower, both thinking that, well, if we can do cloud seeding, maybe we can do something else with some of these experiments. And so that kind of morphed into, well, maybe we can control the weather and let's try some experiments along those lines. And in one experiment in the late 1940s, there was a hurricane that had shifted away from the shore and was heading out to the ocean. And they thought this would be a good chance to test whether hurricanes could be modified, you know, altered or weakened. Except due to natural forces, the hurricane then shifted directions and turned back and made landfall after all. And so that caused a whole lot of uproar saying that, well, they accidentally steered it into the U.S. And so eventually that program was abandoned a couple years later. But geoengineering, I think, is much more realistic because it ties into climate change. There are trillions of dollars, as we know, going into climate change. People believe this like it's a religion. And in my opinion, the worst aspect is they see mankind as the problem. And so what if they spray otherwise toxic chemicals into the air and a few thousand or million people meet an earlier death? I mean, that kind of fits right in with the, with their belief system. So what can you tell us about what may or may not be being sprayed or will be sprayed into the atmosphere as these scientists all go all in on climate change?
Well, the only one I've heard about really got my attention was the one where they were talking about spraying sulfates, SO4 sulfates and SO2 sulfates into the stratosphere, because we know by the Earth's history from volcanic eruptions that these sorts of sulfates get blown into the stratosphere by volcanic eruptions. And if you take a look at some of the more notable ones like Tambora and Krakatoa, they had a measurable effect on the Earth's temperature. But what the people who want to do engineering or geoengineering are forgetting is the amount of SO4s and 2s that go up there into the stratosphere from major volcanic eruptions are in the hundreds of billions of tons of this sort of sulfate. And there's no way anybody could come up with that and get it up there in the amount of time that a volcano ejects it into the stratosphere. If you put some up there, I don't know whether it would have any measurable effect at all. I seriously doubt with the amounts that they could possibly think they're going to put up there compared to what you get with a volcano would make really any difference to the climate at all. But if they could, it could cause a measurable decrease in the amount of solar radiation that would reach the surface and hence cause the Earth to cool. We've already measured that with volcanoes. But I think that their attempts to do it would fail. I don't think they're going to be able to get enough of anything up there in the way of these sulfates into the stratosphere to cause any measurable effect at all. And also, once you put those up into the stratosphere, they mix with water vapor, supercooled water, and are eventually come back and fall out of the stratosphere. They don't just stay up there forever. So I don't think that it would have any success. I just don't think these people have any concept of reality and what sort of forces you would need to overcome anything that nature puts forward. People are just completely oblivious to this. And I heard some all kinds of rumors going around, spreading around on the internet about how Hurricane Helene was directed into the Carolinas by Next Generation Radar, that NOAA was doing that on purpose with the Biden administration, this sort of thing. These things that people claim on the internet about this sort of thing, where we can use radar to steer hurricanes, is complete rubbish and nonsense. After I heard that on the radio, by the way, I sat down and did a calculation just to give your listeners an idea of what the forces of nature are. I just took an average size hurricane, and Helene was a lot stronger than that, but I figured a 100-mile radius of 5 inches per hour of rain in that 100-mile-an-hour radius and 100-knot winds, just to keep the calculations a little more simple. And if you just took an average hurricane with that sort of activity going on with it, if you summed up all the energy and converted it to equivalent electrical energy, you get 7,282.8 trillion watts of power that's generated by just an average strength hurricane. And then if you take a look at what is the instantaneous electrical power that could be generated all across the United States over any instant in time from all the generating capacity that we have. And if all the generators were turned on and running at maximum capacity, the instantaneous power they would generate is 1.3 trillion watts compared to 7,282.8 trillion watts with just an average-sized hurricane. It's so many times over what we could even generate as humans. This is what I mean when I say people that talk about engineering and changing the weather, changing the climate by humans doing things to it, are complete nonsense. These people don't even sit down and do their homework to determine what sort of forces are in play to do the kind of things that they claim that they want to do with this geoengineering stuff. But I can believe that there are stupid enough people in the government that might try or think that they can do this.
Yes.
And
yeah.
there might even be some of them that know. I just don't know. But I just laugh at this stuff when I hear it. It's just so ridiculous. It's just there's no way you can do it.
It's ridiculous, but it also, you know, because I was doing some research on this yesterday, and as you mentioned, one of the things that they're trying to do is experiment with putting sulfur dioxide into the air, and there is some credibility to that because, as you said, you know, the volcanoes, they spew this out, but now they're saying we basically need to recreate a volcano every year, and that would offset potential warming from CO2. But what's ironically puzzling to me is we constantly hear about fossil fuel emissions and that coal and gas and oil are all causing climate change. One of the gases coal and gas and oil emit is sulfur dioxide. So their solution to climate change caused by fossil fuels is to put more of the gases emitted from fossil fuels into the atmosphere. It's kind of strange for the global warmers to say the enemy is emissions, but their answer to the emissions is more emissions, just higher up in the atmosphere as some kind of umbrella against the sun. That seems rather contradictory.
Well, yeah. Well, to begin with, Mark, carbon dioxide is absolutely not the main greenhouse gas that controls the Earth's outgoing radiation balance. It is not. And that's a big lie that these people continue to perpetrate. Water vapor, clouds, and the hydrological cycle are what control the radiation budget of the Earth from the surface. And there's nothing you can do to change that.
Yeah.
CO2 is along for the ride. Its effects are completely dwarfed by the hydrological cycle. And the warming we've had since the start of the satellite record, which is roughly a half a degree Celsius, that warming was caused by a decrease in the reflectivity of solar radiation back to space. We call that the albedo. There's been a very, very slight decrease in cloud cover, and also perhaps haze because we went to cleaner burning fuels. And that has allowed a little bit more solar radiation to come in. And if you take what they've actually been able to measure in the decrease in albedo, which is roughly around 1%, and calculate that out to solar radiation, the match is very good to what the temperature actually increased at.
Yeah.
And okay. So if you do that with carbon dioxide, you don't get anything like that. It doesn't match. It doesn't work out.
Yes, but there's wishful thinking, and that's an important part of science now. So that's...
Oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. That's what they've turned it into. Science has become political. It's just disgusting how these people, these lunatics that have gotten into it, have politicized it. And a lot of this is driven just by grants and wanting money
from
the federal government.
Yeah, I was just going to say they are good salesmen because they have made trillions of dollars off this. All right, it is time for a break. We'll wrap things up with Chuck Weiss after this. And welcome back in our final segment now with Chuck Weiss talking about chemtrails and also geoengineering. I think that's the more realistic and real danger. And so, Chuck, in the little bit of time that we have left here, I'd like to talk about one thing that came up from that article is this notion of unintended consequences. Actually, this was some side research that I had done about spraying sulfur dioxide. And one of the studies showed that the ozone layer could be damaged by these types of things. I mean, would it surprise anyone that arrogant scientists determined to play God about our weather here and climate change because they don't believe in God got it wrong and would end up doing more harm than good?
Well, anytime you're going to put chemicals like this into the atmosphere that are not part of normal activity, you are taking a chance that you could cause some environmental damage. I'm not a chemist, so I don't know whether this would actually affect the ozone that much if they did it or not, but it could. I suppose it's theoretically possible that it could. But what really gets my attention with all these people is the utter absolute stupidity and just not figuring things out or thinking them through real well when even deciding to come up with these, you know, concocting these schemes. They're just not going to work. And I've heard politicians say, well, we don't want to be doing this because we might lose our sovereignty. We could cause environmental damage by steering a storm or causing a storm somewhere else. I mean, you just get into going down a slippery slope once you start doing this thing, because if you can entertain scientific absurdity by saying, well, we did something, we did activity A, and now we're going to say if somebody had a storm or a hurricane that damaged their property over on B, that this activity from A is the cause of it. And then you get into these lawsuits and you get into this ridiculous hand-wringing that there's really little or no proof of. And the danger I see down the path from this is just all the assumptions that get made that are non-scientific that could lead to tons of lawsuits and claims made in the future that if somebody suffered environmental damage over here, well, that was caused by your cloud seeding. It was caused by your geoengineering. And you get into a big conflict about that.
Yeah, giant quagmire. And speaking of that quagmire, I think the big danger here is bad actors, because this technology exists. And there are some companies that are sending up things like balloons full of sulfur dioxide, and they're exploding them in the upper atmosphere. But I mean, really, you think of somebody like Bill Gates, who says that he's interested in this, and China. I mean, what's to stop them from spraying crap all over the atmosphere?
Well, yes, and things like this, when you entertain scientific nonsense and absurdities, which are basically the crux of the argument behind weather geoengineering, once you start down that path, and then, like I said, you get a weather disaster or some major disaster happening in a country that wasn't doing or participating in these experiments, you'll get an accusation or could get an accusation from them that could even start a war. I worry more about that sort of thing than any effect these ridiculous programs are going to have, because they won't have any effect. It's just the superstitions that rise up from them that lead to frivolous lawsuits and finger-pointing that could lead to war and worldwide chaos if we got involved in something like that. That's the stupidity of it. And scientifically, it won't accomplish anything.
Yeah.
But look at what we're doing with CO2. That now has become the devil, and it's destroying life on planet Earth when it has no power to do any such thing. Look how far these goons have spread that and got it into the minds through the education system of a lot of people.
Yeah, and then the problem, of course, is once they are indoctrinated that way, it's very hard to start shaking them from that.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Mark. And that's what I worry about. You could start a war over getting involved in this sort of stuff with all the superstitions that float around because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chuck, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I'm glad to help, Mark, anytime.
While I still don't believe in chemtrails, I just don't see the evidence. There is evidence that people with a lot of money, including taxpayer money, those people believe in geoengineering. And just like belief in global warming, misguided beliefs result in misguided science and misguided results. We've only just scratched the surface of this, and we'll have to come back to it another time. But looking back on this show, doesn't it feel good to have big government on the run for once? That will only keep happening as long as we keep the pressure on, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.